Well, welcome to this week's Evolution Seminar. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Loren Chapman from McGill University. Loren is a professor in the Department of Biology and also a Canada Research Chair in Respiratory Ecology and Aquatic Conservation, which, and a Canada Research Chair is, by the way, a very prestigious faculty position. And it's a very prestigious faculty position. So, Loren did her undergrad at University of Alberta in zoology and then her PhD at McGill. And I met Loren as she was doing her postdoc at Harvard with Carol Leem, a noted fish biologist in the Museum of Comparative Zoology. And that's when we both started interacting in Uganda, where we still work today. Loren studies evolutionary adaptations of fishes related to respiratory physiology and other things, and also aquatic conservation. And she has a very impressive number and quality of publications, in addition to an impressive record of training Ugandan students and postdocs. Really, it's greatly to her credit. The thing I think that stands out most in my mind about Loren is her unerring professionalism. Whether or not we're trudging through the forest together, filthy, dirty, whatever, Loren is always a perfectly professional person, always well organized, always takes excellent care of her students. And there's only one time I can remember that I saw there's a twinge of unprofessionalism, and it was my fault. It was in our early years in Uganda together when Loren was still interested in understanding the ichthyofauna of the country, and I was traveling all, she remembers. I was traveling all around the country for my own reasons. And I came back very excited from a trip to the border with Congo near the Semliki River, where I told her how excited I was that I was able to buy this really cool looking fish with a long snout and was big and silvery. And she's like, oh, that's a momiron. And they're apparently unique fish because they communicate using electric signals. And she was so excited that I bought it for her collection. And then I had to tell her I actually ate it. So I saw a flash of anger, and that's the only time she's been anything other than professional in the whole time I've known her. But today,
I think it was duly provoked.
It was. That was bad. So today we'll be talking about life in low oxygen, hypoxia as a driver of phenotypic divergence in fishes.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm very grateful for you for coming today to let me have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about life in low oxygen and the role of oxygen in driving divergence across fish populations. And I wanted to say the special thanks to Tony Goldberg and Peter McIntyre and Lisa Nodden and Mara for organizing my visit today. It's really been a wonderful time here. I have to get my computer. There we go. Okay, divergent natural selection between environments is a very important mechanism, both creating and maintaining phenotypic divergence, and an important first step in studies of divergent natural selection is simply to document patterns of variation across natural populations. For fishes, there's actually a very rich body of literature on intraspecific variation. Common examples include studies of lotic and lentic systems, such as in explorations of lake and stream stickleback, or predator-no predator sites where Gambusia has been heavily studied to look at these really interesting predator-associated morphologies. So what we're doing in my lab is looking at a slightly different factor, the role of dissolved oxygen and other environmental stressors as divergent selective factors. You might ask why oxygen. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I'll try to convince you that it's an important factor to look at. For fishes, the availability of dissolved oxygen is obviously incredibly important. A physical factor that can limit dispersal pathways, that can constrain growth and survivorship and reproduction and habitat quality, and therefore lead to divergent selective environments. Second, oxygen scarcity is widespread in a natural sense in systems that are characterized by low light and low mixing, particularly in the tropics where you have high temperatures that elevate the rates of organic decomposition and reduce oxygen tensions in the water. So dense tropical wetlands like these ones, this inundated forest in the Amazon, and these floodplain pools in southern Brazil are all examples of habitats that might be characterized by either periodic or chronic hypoxia. Third, why should you be interested in oxygen? Well, hypoxic waters are becoming more widespread as the influx of waste and fertilizers accelerates eutrophication and pollution of water bodies to the extent that hypoxia or low oxygen is now recognized as an environmental issue of global importance to fresh and coastal waters that can result in population declines and massive fish kills and in the production of dead zones, such as in the Gulf of Mexico, which of course has other problems other than oxygen, but also the bottom of Lake Erie and other coastal zones and inland waters throughout the world. So to look at the role of hypoxia in phenotypic divergence, we've actually focused our studies on tropical freshwaters in Africa, particularly those of East Africa, where low oxygen is very widespread in enormous areas of wetlands that are dominated by this sedge papyrus or this grass miscanthidium that you see on the right. The dense papyrus swamps that average 4 to 5 meters in height, so it's like being in a swamp forest. In these dense swamps, low light, low levels of mixing, extraordinarily high rates of organic decomposition produce very low levels of oxygen in the dark tea-stained waters beneath the swamp forest. So it's a very extreme environment. Now, the early accounts of fishes in dense African swamps noted the importance of air-breathing fishes, like the African lungfish and the clarid catfish. So they don't really have a problem with low oxygen stress because they can use atmospheric air. But over the years, we found that there are several non-air-breathing, your typical gill-breathing fish, that also occur in these very extreme environments. Species of more myriads, like the one that Tony ate, cichlids, cypridids, killifishes, and so on. And what's interesting is that many of these species are found in the dense interior of very hypoxic swamps, but also found in well-oxygenated open waters of lakes and rivers. So they experience divergent selective environments with respect to oxygen availability. So to explore the role of swamps in faunal diversification, we began many years ago simply by mapping variation in gill size, which is important for oxygen uptake, across populations from low and high oxygen environments for several species. We used various gill metrics, and just as a quick introduction to the fish gill, we measured the total gill filament length, which is the length of all of the filaments on the four arches on either side of a teleost fish's head. We also integrate total gill filament length with the density of the lamellae. These are the little flap-like structures that are the actual sites of oxygen uptake and their area, and together that gives us an estimate of the total surface area of the gill, which is a good metric for estimating the area for oxygen uptake capacity. So in this figure, what I've represented is the adjusted mean gill size, the gill size adjusted for body size for four of the species that were on the previous figure from three fish families for a population from a hypoxic swamp and a nearby open water site. What I'd like you to notice is that for all four species, the gill size is larger in the swamp population than the open water population, whether it's gill surface area or gill filament length or any metric of gill size. And then we went on to look at other morphophysiological traits over the years, and we found similar patterns of phenotypic divergence across oxygen gradients in characteristics like brain size, where smaller brains are characteristic of species or populations from hypoxic waters. Respiratory behavior, like aquatic surface respiration, where they go up to the surface and skim the surface film. In physiological and biochemical traits, like hematocrit. And also in life history traits, egg size, egg number, and so on and so forth. So together, these studies suggest that morphophysiological variation in response to hypoxic stress may be relatively widespread in nature. So what I'd like to do today is to explore this morphophysiological divergence across oxygen gradients, focusing on two species of African cichlids, and in particular think about the role of developmental plasticity, phenotypic plasticity, in as a mechanism underlying the divergent patterns that we see. So I'm going to describe variation in a widespread haplochromine cichlid fish, Pseudocrenolabris multicolor, from divergent oxygen environments, and then hone in on this species to examine the degree to which developmental plasticity, a change over the lifetime of the individual, contributes to morphological or physiological variation that we see in the field, and then hop to another species to explore the interaction of oxygen and other divergent selective agents in tugging at the morphology or physiology of fishes. So let's start off with Pseudocrenolabris multicolor victoriae, which for obvious reasons we will call something different. This is a widespread haplochromine cichlid. We'll refer to it as pea multicolor, or it's often referred to as blue lips because the males have bright blue lips. This is a very widespread haplochromine cichlid that's found in the Lake Victoria Basin of East Africa. This is Lake Victoria, that's the largest tropical lake in the world, and then throughout the Nile River Basin and other areas. What's cool about this fish is that it's found across an amazingly wide range of environments, from the dense interior of hypoxic swamps to well-oxygenated, fast-flowing rivers and streams, lakes, and so on and so forth. So it experiences various oxygen environments. Like all haplochromine cichlids, this is a lineage of cichlids, these are mouth-brooding fishes. And so the female holds the eggs and young in her mouth until they are ready to feed on their own, in which case they are released. Now, occasionally she'll vacuum them up when a predator comes by, but in general, she holds them through that developmental period. So, in our work on pea multicolor, we focused on two areas of East Africa, both in the country of Uganda, the Mpanga River drainage in the west and this Namagabo region in the east. If we hone in on the Mpanga River Basin just a bit, we can see that it consists of wide, open, flowing channels like you see in the picture down on the bottom, but like many river valleys of East and Central Africa, it's also choked for miles and miles with these dense hypoxic papyrus swamps. On the other side of the country, we have a Namagabo region. Lake Namagabo, which is circled in red, though you may not be able to see it very well, is a satellite of the larger Lake Victoria. And Lake Namagabo and these three other small satellite lakes are all surrounded by this very dense Miscanthidium swamp that you see up on your right there, very hypoxic, in contrast to the well-oxygenated open waters of the lakes. So, let me show you an example of oxygen concentration measured over 1 year in one swamp and one open water system from each drainage, just to convince you that we do have divergent environments. So as you can see here, the average monthly dissolved oxygen levels are reasonably high in the open waters and then very low in the swamp systems, and this is a repeatable pattern across the drainages. To see if gill size variation, that is, large gills and swamp populations, is a repeatable pattern within pea multicolor, what we did is we sampled 10 populations from these two areas. And as an example, I'm going to just show you the results for these four sites for two metrics of gill size in this little cichlid. So this is hemibranch area, that's the area of all of the arches on the gills, on the gill surface, and then total gill filament length, and I've already explained that one. And what I'd like you to notice is that for both the Mpanga River drainage and the Namagabo system, the swamp population has a much larger gill size than open water populations that are nearby. So these presence of these larger gilled and smaller gilled phenotypes, they're quite dramatic. These differences can be up to 30%, suggests that there must be some mechanism that's maintaining this pattern in the field, and it's likely that there is some sort of trade-off between low and high oxygen sites, such that the phenotype that performs well, this large gilled phenotype, performs well in the low oxygen habitats, but doesn't perform as well in the high oxygen habitats. So what kind of trade-off might you expect to see? The large proliferation of the gills that we see here could certainly affect other structures in the head, like the trophic muscles and the head size. That could maybe affect swim performance or feeding performance. So as an example, we have measured a series of traits that might be affected by gill proliferation. And this is head width for the two sets of populations. And you can see that it's larger in the swamp-dwelling fish than in the fish from the normoxic site. Could affect swimming performance. Then we focused in on the Namagabo system. We measured several other traits that might trade off with gill size, and we found the three trophic muscles and the pharyngeal jaws were smaller in the swamp population than the open water population that could affect feeding performance. For the Namagabo system, we also looked at brain size, and these are the raw data for the relationship between brain mass and body mass for the same two populations. And what I wanted you to notice is that for a fish of a given body mass, the open water fish from the high oxygen site have a larger brain size. So we have lots of variation there to play with, and this may reflect the energetic constraints of an oxygen-limited environment. Oxygen availability has also been shown in many studies to affect growth and reproductive traits and so on, so we also explored patterns of divergence in life history traits among populations of P. multicolor, and this work was done in large part by my former graduate student, PhD student Aaron Reardon. As part of Aaron's dissertation research, she had a field component where she looked at a variety of life history traits across 8 populations in these systems. A wide range of dissolved oxygen, or DO, was represented. As an example of Aaron's findings, in this figure, what I'm showing you is the percentage of females with mature gonads plotted against their standard length. And the green populations are the swampers, and the blue populations are the open water fish. This L50 line is routinely used in the fish literature as an estimate of size and maturity. It's the size at which about 50% of the fish are mature. So what I'd like to point out is simply that the swamp populations tend to have a smaller size of maturity than their open water conspecifics. What else is different among these populations? Well, all of these swampers were also characterized by a much smaller egg size. The smaller egg size then transformed into a smaller embryo size. This provides a summary of some of the data that Aaron collected. It shows the mean mass of embryos at different stages within the mouth of the female for fishes that were collected from low and high oxygen sites. And you can see that across all these stages, the swampers have a lower size, embryo size, egg size, than the open water fish. Why be smaller under hypoxia, though? Well, there could be a potential energetic advantage. It may be physiologically beneficial to have a smaller surface area to volume ratio. At this size, a lot of the oxygen uptake is occurring through the skin in these fishes. We've also discovered in studies since that time that these fish from hypoxic sites also have a faster development time, which may be advantageous in an extreme environment. So what I hope I've been able to show you so far is that we do have a lot of intraspecific variation in this species, gill size and jaw size and trophic muscle size and life history traits and so on. The next question we were interested in is the degree to which phenotypic plasticity might contribute to the morphological and physiological variation that we see. So we've done over the years a series of rearing experiments in the lab. And in the most recent of these experiments, my former PhD student, Erica Crispo, reared F1 offspring from 6 populations from this Mpongo River cage. She also looked at the population genetic structure of this system. She looked at 2 swamp sites. The top one is very isolated in terms of distance from the main river, and these are both characterized by very hypoxic conditions. She looked at 2 high oxygen sites, but they occur near the junction of the swamp, and so they do receive swamp input and they're sort of fluctuating but high. And then she looked at 2 sites that are relatively removed from any interaction with the swamp. And here's Erica's design. She took mom and dad from the field, brought them back to McGill University, and then reared for all 6 population, 7 families of full sibs. When a mom had produced the young and was brooding them, the broods were split into 2 treatments, a low oxygen treatment and a high oxygen treatment. Those were reared for 1 year, after which time they were harvested for measures of gill traits and brain mass and body shape. And what Erica did was focus on 2 males from each tank for these measures because of the complexity of the measures, and because the mouth brooding the female changes a bit the architecture of the head. So for the gill apparatus, we looked at 5 gill metrics, and I've explained some of these to you, but basically they all relate to the size of the gill. And what we did is we tried to integrate the information on these gill metrics by standardizing them to a common body mass, and then using principal component analysis to produce 1 principal component factor that explained over 80% of the variance and related primarily to gill size. So this is just a way of getting 1 trait for me to show you in the next figure. I'll spend a bit of time on this figure. We have gill size over here, and then we have fish reared under low or high oxygen conditions. The colored lines join the trait means, the mean size of gills for fish F1 offspring reared under either low or high oxygen conditions, and then each one is a different population. So the important point here is that there's a very strong treatment effect in all of the populations, no matter where they were from. Gill size was much larger in the low oxygen reared fish than in the high oxygen reared fish. And then we also had some marginal population and treatment effects as well. If we look at univariate traits, just so that we can sort of sink our teeth into the magnitude of the difference, total gill filament length was 38% larger in the little guys reared under hypoxia, and hemibranch area was actually 56% larger. So these are very large differences in gill size that are environmentally induced. And we might ask, well, why have such plastic effects? Why do we have such little evidence for local adaptation in the gills? Is it possible that local adaptation might be constrained by gene flow in this system? So in our studies of population structure on the Impanga River drainage using neutral markers, we have found low genetic divergence at microsatellite markers, suggesting that contemporary gene flow among those sites is relatively high, or that colonization was recent, followed by insufficient time for neutral divergence to occur. Why is this important? Well, gill size is possible that gill size plasticity might have facilitated colonization of these different or divergent environments, and or that contemporary gene flow between the environments might result in selection for plasticity at sort of a metapopulation scale. So that's where we are with that study at the moment. What about the brain mass? So we dissected the brains out of the fish and then weighed them and got an estimate of brain mass for each fish. And we did again find some evidence for developmental plasticity, but it becomes more interesting with brain mass. This figure is set up the same way. So we've got the brain size over here, and we've got the little guys reared under low or high oxygen. Here's a mean value for low oxygen reared sims, and this line just joins the trait means. There is a treatment effect, so fishes that are reared or develop under low oxygen conditions tend to have high oxygen conditions tend to have a larger brain size. On average, it's about 10% larger. But we also have a significant population effect and an interaction. So some populations were actually more plastic than others. And to try to summarize this information in a figurative way, I just put together this figure that tries to summarize the patterns. And basically, we have large, less plastic brains, and we have small, more plastic brains. If you look up on the right-hand side, we have a large, less plastic brain. If we look down here in this river site, we have also a large, less plastic brain. This particular site is characterized by high oxygen throughout the year. It's quite some distance from any interaction with the swamp. It's possible that the high oxygen conditions permit or do not restrict the ability to grow large brains. The presence of the large brain size in the upstream site that's circled by purple was more surprising to us. Remember, these are lab-derived data, but it was surprising to us because we would expect selection for small brains in this chronically hypoxic swamp site. The presence of the large brains in this population might be made possible via evolution of other traits that enhance oxygen uptake capacity, so that the metabolic demands of the brain, or the metabolic oxygen for the brain, is not so limited. It's possible that local adaptation in this area here for these other mechanisms may be precluded by this movement and closeness of the low oxygen and the high oxygen environments. So nonetheless, even though it is complex, I think the important features are that we do have an element of developmental plasticity, but also evidence for population effects and variation in plasticity across sites. Okay, now we've got these incredibly large gills, and we know that they're up to 56% larger in fish reared under hypoxic conditions, so that ought to affect something else. And we did look at various other possibilities, and one was variation in body shape that might be related to, either directly or indirectly, the low oxygen environment that they're reared in. To address this question, all of the fish that we showed or used in the previous figures were photographed on their left sides, and then 15 of these landmarks, these are sites that you could reliably find on every individual fish, were scored. And we used a tool called geometric morphometric analysis to obtain partial and relative warp scores. And what are these? Well, the partial warps are really just two-dimensional vectors that represent some kind of localized change in shape. So it might be shape change in this area or that area. And the relative warps, it's like doing a PCA, a principal component analysis of the partial warps. It takes all this variation and collapses it into independent variables that explain most of the differences in body shape. So I've tried to summarize the major body shape effects in this next figure. And the most striking result for us was that we found that bodies tended to be generally deeper and shorter under low oxygen conditions. But this effect was obviously more pronounced for some populations than for others. Why is this important? Well, it could be that these differences in body shape, and I must say that they are magnified in these thin plates, blind configurations to try to illustrate the effect to you more easily. But these differences certainly could affect the streamline of the fish, potentially swimming performance. So we did carry out a series of swim performance studies on fishes from one population reared under these alternate conditions, and we have found evidence for trade-offs in burst swim speed that might be important in maintaining these divergent phenotypes in the field. The amount of gill size plasticity did surprise us, I must say, but I also want to point out that we found similar levels of developmental plasticity in the gill size of other East African cichlids, such as the one on the left, which is undescribed, we call him Ponga Blue, and the one on the right. But one of the most important or interesting, I think, questions that arises when you have developmental plasticity of such a magnitude is, well, is it reversible? And why is this important? Well, it is important because it has implications for the potential adaptiveness of phenotypic plasticity. So if the phenotypically response early in the life of P. multicolor is to produce small gills because it's growing in this luxuriously well-oxygenated river, then this could compromise it later on if it moves to a low-oxygen site where it doesn't have adequate compensatory mechanisms. So there's a risk if you start off with small gills but then move to a swampy environment later on. And so this could potentially restrict the evolutionary consequences of plasticity in this species. So we wanted to know, is the plasticity that we see reversible? And so we just completed recently a study where we tried to address this question. What did we do? Well, we looked just at one population from the field. We knew it was relatively plastic. And then we took three families, three moms and dads, split up the broods, so this time we have four treatments. We have a hypoxic treatment where they were reared to maturity under hypoxia. Then we had a treatment where they started off at the same level, but after 20 weeks they were switched to a normoxic environment. And then we start them off in well-oxygenated conditions and just let them go. We start them off under normoxia and then switch them to hypoxia at 20 weeks. And the question is, do we have any evidence that the developmental trajectory was set in stone, or is it somehow reversible? And so I've tried to summarize some representative graphs here of our findings. These are two metrics of gill size that we've seen before, hemibranch area, just the area that all the arches takes up, and then gill filament length, the length of all the filaments. They show the same pattern, so I'll just focus on this graph over here. These are the adjusted means, or their mean values adjusted to a common body mass for fishes that were reared under all of these four treatments. What I'd like you to notice is that if a fish starts off in hypoxia and is just left there until maturity, it grows, as we would expect, large gills. If we switch it, if we start it in well-oxygenated conditions, but then we switch it to hypoxia, it also produces large gills, so it catches up. If we start off in normoxia, as predicted, we leave it in normoxia and we get small gills. If we start off in hypoxia, we also end up with small gills if it's transferred to normoxia. So we do have some evidence that these are highly flexible fish with respect to plasticity of the gills. It's possible that gill plasticity is relatively cheap to maintain. So I want to just, at this stage, summarize this P. multicolor story, and then I have one last section where we try to integrate different divergent selected agents. What I hope I've been able to show you about P. multicolor is that dissolved oxygen seems to be a relatively strong predictor of intraspecific variation in this species, along with many other East African fishes that we've looked at, and also some fishes in Texas and Florida that we've looked at and I haven't mentioned here. There's a large element of developmental plasticity in response to hypoxia, but also evidence for an interaction between long-term selection and plasticity, and we saw that in the brain mass as an example. And not only are the organs primarily involved in oxygen uptake, the gills affected by hypoxia, but surrounding structures as well. And this might be important because it could contribute to trade-offs, performance trade-offs, where the large gilled phenotype performs best over here, but if it moved over here, it wouldn't perform as well, and vice versa. And finally, we found some evidence that developmental plasticity and gill size is reversible. So this is nice because I think it demonstrates that oxygen is an important divergent selective agent, but unfortunately, life is clearly more complex than dealing with a lot of oxygen or a little oxygen. So an important next step for us has been to try to integrate the different selective agents and look at how they tug at body morphology and physiology. And a good candidate for trading off with gill size is durophagy, feeding on hard foods, because you only have so much room in the laterally compressed head of a teleost fish. So this led us to explore the interaction of oxygen and other diversifying agents. In particular, what I'll talk about today is the interaction of oxygen and food in this other cichlid, Acetoriochromis alati, which I'll just call alati for short. We need some common names for these guys. This is also a widespread haplochromine cichlid that's found throughout the Lake Victoria Basin and up into the Nile River Basin. It's well known, or it was well known early on in studies of this fish, for being a good snail eater. And in fact, it was used for biocontrol programs on snails for a long time, which didn't work, but we can talk about that another time. Anyway, when early studies, what they did is they reared this fish on snail diets and on soft food diets. And if you rear them on a snail diet, you get a very hypertrophy pharyngeal jaw. So in cichlid fishes, you've got the oral jaws here, and then you have pharyngeal jaws here, which are like crushing plates that grind food. This is a pharyngeal jaw. You can see that when this fish was reared on a snail diet, it produces this very hypertrophied jaw with these big molar-like teeth. If you rear sibs from the same family on a soft food diet, like tetramin flake food or something, you get this small non-hypertrophied form. And also, there are differences in the jaw muscle architecture as well. So you have hypertrophied muscles in the snail eaters. So this is interesting, because we have a fish that is found in low oxygen environments where it ought to have large gills, but it might also have these big chunky jaws, and where do they put it all? We found in the field that there is variation across sites in both gill size and trophic morphology, and I'm just going to talk about two sites today. I'll give you an overview of the field situation and then take them into the lab and grow them under different conditions. So we looked at two field populations of alati, Lake Navigabo, this is a site we've already talked about, and then Lake Saka, which I'll introduce you to in just a second. In Lake Navigabo, this particular species is not found in the dense interior of the swamps, but is very restricted to these wetland bays that are hypoxic. Now, this lake is actually very interesting because it doesn't have many snails or clams. It has almost no snails. Consequently, Acetoriochromis alati can't be a snail eater in this system, and it's not. Our diet studies have shown that. In Lake Saka, we have a very different situation. It is a hyper-eutrophied lake. It's been hyper-eutrophied for many years. Oxygen concentration where we catch alati is usually about 10 milligrams per liter and up to 15, so that's between about 110% saturation to super saturation. We know that snails are in this lake. A year of diet studies have shown us that alati will occasionally feed on snails. So we have two systems, Lake Navigabo, low DO or low dissolved oxygen, low snails, Lake Saka, high DO, high snails. Do we see differences in the architecture of the gills or the jaws? And the answer is yes. This is a relationship between gill surface area and body mass. So it's the kind of figure that I've shown you before, and what I want to point out simply is that the fish from the low-oxygen Lake Navigabo site have a much larger gill surface area. It's about 50% larger. But what's also interesting is we do find the predicted difference in the trophic morphology between these two systems. Lake Saka fish have these lovely hypertrophied jaws with these big chunky molars, and they do take snails in their diet, though not all the time. In Lake Navigable, where they don't feed on snails, they have these very fine jaws with these fine teeth, and they take small insects and other particulate matter. So what we did is we took parental stock from these two populations to the lab, and we took three families from each population, and we reared them in a split brood design. And this time we had four treatments with an integration of oxygen and food. So we reared them under hypoxia in snails, hypoxia and flake food, soft food, high oxygen and snails, and high oxygen and soft food. And then we measured a series of traits, some of which I've already talked about today, related to the gills, to the trophic muscles, and also to the jaws and the brain. And we did this for three fish from each family per treatment per population. So for the gill apparatus, we measured all of the same traits that I've shown you before, but we also added in one. We added in this distance here between the tips of all of the arches that we call gill arch length, because we thought it might be affected by the proliferation of the gills. We also measured certain surrounding structural elements. We looked at the geniohyoideus muscle, this one here, also the sternohyoideus muscle here, and then these are the pharyngeal jaws back here. So the oral jaws are here, and that's where the pharyngeal jaws sit if they grind food. We looked at those. And then we looked at brain mass. We looked at brain mass, and we also looked this time in a little more detail at the various components of the brain. We answered the volume of these different components. So what did we find? What I'm going to try to do is just give you some examples of univariate traits in each of the different categories of response variables. So this is total gill filament length, and there's a bit too much information on this slide, so I'll just spend a bit of time. These are fish reared under high oxygen or low oxygen conditions. And the fish that are reared on a snail diet are represented by the hard lines, and the fish that are reared on the soft diet by these soft stippled lines. And then the fish of hypoxia origin, the fish of Lake Navigable, represented by green and blue, represent the fish of high oxygen origin. So what's the point of this graph? Well, the main point is that there was a very strong treatment effect. No matter what population they were from, no matter what food they were reared on, they all showed a much larger gill filament length under low oxygen conditions. So again, we have this strong element of developmental plasticity. But we also found a significant interaction between oxygen and food on gill traits. And this was accounted for mostly by one particular trait, which is the length of this area here. And you can see that there's a significant dissolved oxygen by food interaction. So when the fishes are reared on a soft food diet, they tend to have the same gill arch length under both conditions. But if they're reared on a hard food diet, then the gill arch length increases when they're reared under low oxygen. And we think, so what happens is the gill shifts from looking like this to sort of looking like that. And we think that this probably reflects a trade-off between the trophic apparatus and the gill size and the need to fit both into a compact head space. What about the jaws, the pharyngeal jaws? Here we got pretty much what we predicted. Again, we have the same setup, and what I'd like you to notice is that we have a very strong food effect that we'd expect, but also a population effect. So these are the Lake Navigable fish. They're the fish that don't have mollusks in their normal diet, and they tend to have smaller jaws overall. This is the tooth area. It's the area of all of those molar-like teeth on the pharyngeal jaw. And then the Lake Saka fish that do include mollusks in their diet on a regular basis seem to have the ability to maintain those large jaws even when they're fed on different foods. But there's also an interesting food effect. So when the fish are fed on hard foods, within each population they have bigger jaws. And this simply supports earlier studies that show that their jaw structure is developmentally plastic in response to the food base. So no interesting interactions there. But we do have some interesting interactions in the surrounding structural elements. As an example, this is the length of the sternohyoideus muscle, sort of runs along here. And what you can see is that when fish are reared on snails, those are the solid lines, they tend to have a larger sternohyoideus length when they're reared under high oxygen conditions, but it changes when they're reared under low oxygen conditions. So the important point here is that the way that the muscle responds to the food depends on whether it's reared under low or high oxygen conditions. An interesting interaction between two selective agents. Okay, what about brain size? Well, for brain size, we were only able to look at fishes that were fed on the soft food diet. So diet isn't particularly important in what I'm going to show you now, but I think the results are interesting nonetheless. So for fish reared under high oxygen conditions, from both populations, the brain mass was greater, as we saw in the pseudocrenolabrus multicolor. So if they have more oxygen, they grow bigger brains. But what's interesting is that there were also differences in the components of the brain. And most of this difference in brain size was due to two components of the brain, in particular, the telencephalon volume. So here, all I want you to notice is that if fish are reared under low oxygen conditions, the volume of this component of the brain gets smaller, and it's also smaller in the fish from the hypoxia site of origin, where the parental stock were from Lake Navigable. Now, the telencephalon is sort of an interesting region of the brain because it's involved, apparently, in processing information in social interactions and so on. So if you have fish under hypoxia, it's possible that this sort of reduction in this component of the brain might be correlated with differences in social interactions. In recent behavioral experiments, we have found that the social cohesion of groups and the amount of the frequency of reproductive displays goes down in fishes that are from hypoxic sites or reared under hypoxia. So let me just summarize this last component of the study. We found a strong developmental plasticity in all of the trait groups that I showed you in this particular rearing experiment. We also found, as we would expect, interactions between diet and oxygen. And this is pretty interesting to me because it suggests that non-respiratory factors might influence the extent of divergence in the gills or other respiratory traits and vice versa. And these sort of interactions, these trade-offs across ecological domains may be very important in determining the architecture of adaptation, but we're sort of just starting to look at these. And with that, what I'd like to acknowledge is that, of course, this work was carried out in collaboration with colleagues, my graduate students, undergraduates, and field assistants, acknowledge some funding organizations. And I must say I'm really grateful to all of you for listening, and I'd be happy to take any comments or questions at this stage. Thank you. Yes, Mara.
In your body shape, was the shorter body shape associated with increased surface area?
Of the gill or of the body?
Of the body.
You know what? We didn't measure the surface area of the body. That's a good point. I think it would actually be, given the shape of the fish, the shorter, deeper body would be associated with a smaller total surface area of the fish. And the more linear shape is a larger surface area. But we did find a difference in their swimming performance, in their ability to burst swim speed. Yeah. Yes?
Did you have any mortality in your treatment groups, especially when you're moving fish?
That's a really, and do you mean in the treatment groups in the lab?
In the laboratory.
Yes. So we have to keep very careful track of mortality. Anne has a really good question, a good point there, because you might select, if you don't measure your dead fish, then you might be selecting for a particularly good group of fish that can persist. And so we check for that. We have very low mortality in the juvies. And one of the reasons that we work on the cichlids is they produce these large, well-behaved competitive offspring that seem to get through the egg stage very easily. We keep track of mortality and then we test whether there's a difference between treatments or among treatments, and we haven't had that to date. They do get really nasty when they get old. They're very aggressive. The males are very aggressive, and so most of our mortality occurs after they've matured. Go ahead, please.
So why did you choose 20 weeks for the reversibility experiment? Is there a special developmental time?
No, there's no special developmental time point. What we did is we looked at sort of changes in body mass over time, and we tried to predict. We had already looked at gill variation in groups that size, so we knew that it had already diverged, and it was a first step. So what you want to do then is to take this a step further and look at different stages along the way, which we haven't done. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I'm wondering if any of the systems you've worked on have a lot of variability within them in terms of oxygen environment? Because that can provide opportunities for species to, you know, move from low to high,
yep.
And there could be factors that keep species in a low oxygen environment, even though they prefer to be in high.
Yes, so you mean, do we have heterogeneity in the oxygen environment within a lake or within, yeah, absolutely. What's interesting is that in studies we've done, not on this species, but on other species using tag and recapture, we have found that within the swamp system,
They do select for microenvironments that have higher levels of oxygen in the dry season when conditions are most severe. And they also select for the species that we were looking at, it was a cypritid, for areas of the swamp where there's an open water surface, which they probably use for surface skimming. So there is that sort of thing going on. But what's really interesting is that with the study that I showed you where we reared multiple populations under low oxygen, it's always hard to keep everything the same in a lab, right? And so we monitor, we have an oxygen controlling system, we set it and we hope it's perfect, but it's not. So you have variation among tanks. So if we looked just within the low oxygen treatment, which varied like this much in oxygen, we still found a positive relationship across tanks. So we had tank effects that were related to oxygen. So they can respond to very small changes. Yeah. Please go ahead.
So the populations that you chose, the species that you chose are from a mega environment that includes a number of different environmental regulators, and in your experiments suggest that there's a benefit to plasticity. If you repeated your rearing experiments on a population, say you bought at a pet store, or a population that doesn't have proximate populations of, under different environments, and you raised them in low oxygen and high oxygen and made the same measurements. Have you done that? Has anybody done that?
It's a really good question. We started off with a species that we thought would be very plastic, and we expected there to be a high level of developmental plasticity. Then what we did is we took from that same river system, we have a nice set of species that have more restricted patterns of habitat use but are closely related. So we reared this other riverine cichlid that can't penetrate swamps, to our knowledge. Under the same conditions. And we found surprisingly, disappointingly, that it had equally plastic gill size variation. But when we looked at another character, the surface area of the gill, there was a population effect. The interesting thing is that the gills were equally plastic, but the brains were not. And the brains were not as plastic in this particular species that is more restricted in its environmental distribution and potentially gene flow, which is what you might predict, that there's that the degree of developmental plasticity might be related to the costs, the evolutionary costs of maintaining plasticity. Yeah. Anything else? Please.
So you observed that in the reverse experiment, when you had oxidative conditions first and then hypoxia, you actually get bigger volume of the gills in two species. So do you think it's correlated with the development and optimal conditions first, and then you have better response to low oxygen conditions, or you have no idea?
I'm not quite sure. I
follow. Do you want to show the plot for reverse?
I guess I could do that. Do we have time?
Okay. Oh shoot. Okay. Well, I know. End of slideshow. Why don't you just re-ask your question, and I think
The question is, so when you compare the volume of, or let's say your measurements for the gills,
mm-hmm.
in the experiment when they were just in hypoxia, and then they were in high oxygen condition, and then hypoxia,
right.
In both species you had higher actually mean
right.
for the ones which first were in oxygen conditions and then in hypoxia.
Well, they're not significantly different. So if they were reared under normoxia and switched to hypoxia, they had gills that were not significantly different from the ones that started off in the hypoxic condition. They both got big, even though it looks like they were a little smaller.
And they look like this in both species.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it could be a power issue. But I think we actually had pretty small error bars in a lot of fish. But it's a good point. And I wouldn't have expected a complete sort of catch-up. I would have expected there to be intermediate phases. But in fact, they weren't. Yes, please.
Is there any evidence that, normoxic fish evolved from hypoxic fish somewhere?
So the putative origin of this particular lineage is that it was probably a riverine lineage that then colonized swamps. And so although the evolutionary history of the hapochromine cichlids is a contentious issue, but in this particular group, it's thought to be of riverine origin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pete?
Is there any critically low oxygen point at which it no longer makes sense to send blood through your lamellae? I mean, is there a point where you actually just start to, because I know tadpoles, they actually will lose oxygen to the water, and so they just shunt, they just go to the center plate through the gills?
Well, we've looked at the, it's a good point, we've looked at both aerobic and anaerobic pathways using biochemical assays in this particular species, the Pseudocrenolabris multicolor. And when they are reared under low oxygen conditions or of low oxygen origin, they tend to have a greater emphasis on aerobic pathways that go to the brain. They seem to protect the brain from having to go anaerobic by having anaerobic pathways that don't go to the brain. Does that make sense? So they have good anaerobic capabilities. LDH levels are high, and so on. But in addition, when you look at the response at the biochemical level of different tissues, the brain is more protected. Yeah. Anything else? One more. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I'm curious about these embryos, and eggs that you have small RNA, the physiological argument is kind of tempting there. Do you know if that has any morphological effect on the embryos themselves? Have you ever looked at patterns of cell division or something like that to see if the embryo itself has to do a different program?
This is something we'd love to look at, because the faster developmental response is really interesting, and actually it's not something that is, it'll happen whether you acclimate a female to low oxygen, whether you rear her under low oxygen, or whether you take it from the field. So something triggers, it's a maternal effect or upregulation of gene expression that happens in the mouth of the mom. And the only thing we've done so far is to look at the metabolic rate of the eggs, and also the vascularization of the egg itself. And the eggs are the outside is heavily vascularized. And interestingly, the metabolic rate of the eggs at the same stage, if they are measured from a hypoxic mom and a normoxic mom, the metabolic rate is actually faster in the hypoxic conditions, which probably aids in speeding up the developmental time. But that finding is one of those things that you find on the side that becomes really interesting, and that's where we are right now. We found it, and now it's interesting, and we need to do something with it. Anything else? Okay, one more. Yes, sir.
Do fish have just one kind of hemoglobin, or do they have multiple hemoglobins?
They're very well known for having multiple hemoglobins, yes.
Do those respond to the composition? Does the profile of hemoglobin molecule types change
with hypoxia? I can't speak for our own species, because we've only measured overall hemoglobin levels and hematocrit. We haven't done anything fancy, but there's a very strong group of colleagues that are doing similar studies down the Amazon out of Manaus, and they've looked very carefully at these multiple hemoglobins and found that there is different patterning if the fish are from a hypoxic environment or acclimated to that condition. They haven't done the rearing experiments.
What about ice fish in the Antarctic, where they have no hemoglobin?
Oh, those are too cool. Yeah, yeah. There's a group of fish in the Notophthenioidea in the Antarctic that have antifreeze and no hemoglobin. And I don't study those. I think they're enormously interesting, but I don't know much about them. Yeah, I kind of like the climate. Anything else? I think we better shut down then. Thanks so much. It was really a good discussion.